Welcome to the Full of Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording at 1:29 p.m. That is Pacific Summer Time. Today is Friday, so it's the big picture long-term video and audio for the various different asset classes. I thought we'd kick off with the Wuxia shadow banking rate for the Federal Reserve funds rate, because this index was not updated for about 4 years. So when I saw it today and saw that it had been, that they'd started updating it again, I was really rather enthused. Because there are a couple of things that are, I think, really important to highlight, and it is that the real rate out there in the financial world is not really what we see in terms of the nominal rate. So we've definitely seen that there is a clear downtrend, and that after every tightening we get a lower high and subsequently in a lower low. And we had a lengthy period of tightening all the way up from the lows in 2014 up to the peak in 2019. And then that was a tightening in the order of about 550 basis points. So it was a significant tightening. It was on par with the kind of tightening that we had in subsequent areas. And in fact, it was larger than the one up from the lows in 2003 to the peak in 2006, and not all that far away from the peak, the tightening that we had in the early 1990s either. So that's one point. The second is that we went way into negative territory in the period from about 2009 through to 2014, and that was completely in the face of the nominal rate, which never went below zero. Subsequently, we are now back below the zero bound. So this is a great way of thinking about the fact that we have got extraordinarily accommodative financial conditions. And also that it is acting as a clear stimulus for the financial sector, for the and more broadly the entire financial markets, as well as the wider economy. There is the other point is that we could anticipate, based on history, that it will go to a new low. Then, and that of course also supports the view that central banks don't generally withdraw liquidity early. We've generally seen historically that they have acted late to recessionary problems. On this occasion, that was not the case. They acted with alacrity to ensure that there was ample liquidity provided because of the pandemic, but that doesn't mean that they're going to withdraw it in a hurry. And when we look at what happened today in terms of jobs figures, where there was an anticipation that the USA would add 1 million jobs, and they ended up adding about 266,000, which is a substantial miss, it helps to highlight the determination of the Federal Reserve that they are not going to raise interest rates or engage in any kind of tightening activity or tapering until they are absolutely sure that their objectives are about to be realized. So that's a tailwind for risk assets. And when we then think about other measures of liquidity, we can think then about the Goldman Financial Conditions Index. And I think it's also good to look at this with lots of back history, because it tells us quite clearly that we had this incredible spike where liquidity was extremely rare in 2008. And it got all the way back to levels that hadn't been seen since the 1980s. And it also helps to highlight that we are at levels of financial easiness that have never been seen before. So there is this incredible swell of money floating around the world. And the commonality that we have right now between financial conditions and high yield spreads is also something that's, I think, extremely important, because it helps to highlight that, yes, we did have a problem with high yield spreads, and it was growing from the end of 2018 when we saw the initial breakout. then it could have turned into a really significant problem. Now, again, the spike that we had in high yield spreads was largely curtailed by the massive amount of money that was created. But it is worth highlighting that one of the things that investors were particularly worried about in 2019 was the maturity wall. And they were worried about the fact that we were going to have a problem because so many companies had to refinance debt, and it was up to the tune of approximately $2 trillion between about 2019 and 2023, and that it could cause indigestion in the global markets. It could have caused a fallen angel scenario where investment grade was getting downgraded into junk. And yet now we're at a point where high yield spreads are close to record lows, where financial conditions are extremely accommodative, and what it has in fact done has allowed large numbers of corporations and borrowers to refinance at historically extremely accommodative rates, and therefore it has taken this maturity wall and pushed it further into the future. So generally, the maturity on this debt is about 5 years, so the problem that could have arisen in 2019 is not even going to begin to become an issue until at least 2024 or 2025. And therefore, this cause of concern that had been rising ahead of the pandemic is no longer anything to worry about. Now, then, there is also the question about the continued performance of the emerging market debt. And there's a lot of local currency short-term debt that needs to be refinanced in 2021 in the emerging markets. There's also a solid slug of local currency long-term debt as well. Foreign currency debt isn't really that much of an issue for emerging markets, but there's plenty that needs to be refinanced. So we can definitely say that some of the maturity wall has been removed for the corporate sector. Now the bigger question is, what about the emerging markets sector? And this is particularly relevant when we look at the outlook for the dollar. The Asia dollar index has now clearly bounced from the region of the trend mean, and this looks like a clear recovery trajectory. And this trend downwards in terms of the currency has been going on since 2011. And that period around 2011 is particularly important because we had this incredible rebound in the Asian stock markets off the lows in 2008, and it persisted all the way through until 2011. And then the dollar turned around and it went into this lengthy bull market versus the Asian currencies. And that represented a very long period of time when emerging markets underperformed the developed markets, and Wall Street moved to be the go-to market for all kinds of speculation because international investors had the luxury that they could pick up the currency, the yield, and the capital appreciation all in one go. And it's exactly that triumvirate is what attracts people to emerging markets. So they generally don't begin to move until they have the currency on their side. And that does now look like it's going to be the case. And then when we think about the Latin America dollar index, well, it has been incredibly depressed, and it has fallen much more aggressively and bounced less than the Asia dollar index. And that peak was not in 2011, it was in 2008. And the index today is still only about a third of where it was back in 2008. So as we then think about the commodity complex, we can think about the fact that the London Metals Index is clearly breaking on the upside. So this is all of the industrial metals, and It's rapidly coming back up towards the highs put in 2007 and 2011. This has been a profoundly long range. And when we think about what happens in terms of commodity prices, they generally spend these extremely long periods of time ranging, and then we get breakouts. And it's, I think, particularly relevant that we have a sequence of higher reaction lows within this long range. And it's incredibly volatile, where we have 100% trough to peak swings. And we're rapidly coming in on the old high. But then we also need to pay attention to the best performers. And copper has been leading on the upside. And it pushed on to a new all-time high in here today. The interesting tidbit that came out of the markets for copper today was Glencore basically saying that they would require a price of $15,000 a ton to invest in significant new supply. So copper miners are in this interesting environment where we have supply inelasticity meets rising demand. The copper miners, they are very leery about investing in additional new supply because significant world-class copper resources take decades to produce and to build the necessary infrastructure. If we think about the fact, and it happens at the end of nearly every big bull market in copper, that people start talking about the copper mountain in Congo. And of course, there's a lot of cobalt coming out of the Congo as well. But the reality is that to get it out, you need a massive railway, you need incredible infrastructure, and you need massive amounts of material brought into the area. And then, of course, you need the security in terms of governance. And all of those things look realizable after years on the upside because the potential returns are so attractive. But in order to get to a point where confidence increases to that extent, then you need prices to go up a lot. And you need, particularly, the financial sector to be confident enough that they can supply all of those billions of dollars necessary to build these mines. And that means prices have to not just go up for a little bit, they have to go up for years so that you can have 1 year, 3 year, 5 year comparisons of where prices have been, where they are today, and the growth rate, and be able to draw pretty linear charts in order to really get the finance on side. So that's certainly something that's worth considering as we see these prices continuing to push higher. Of course, copper is also on the cusp of these new bull markets, where there's significant quantities and really tonnage of copper required for wind turbines. And then we have the fact that electric vehicles require much more copper as well. Of course, the renewable energy sector has pulled back of late, and it's now in the region of the trend mean. That is equally true for the wind sector and for the solar sector. And I find it interesting that the commonality that we see today with solar, which has been around for quite some time, and the IPOs, which are new companies, they're all now trading below their respective trend means. The SPAC index is also still under pressure. I think important point here is that despite the fact that we had the jobs news today, which I think sent the message to the market that we're not about to have tapering anytime soon and that we still have a very liquid environment, we haven't seen a great deal of enthusiasm coming through today for these highly speculative assets. And that is despite the fact that they represent the key, I think, beneficiaries from a new carbon-based economy or a carbon absence-based economy. Carbon emissions continue to march higher. And the reality is that the European Commission wants them at 100 euro, so the chances are that that is eventually where they will top out. Of course, what it means is a doubling in the cost of carbon for all emitters. So carbon represents the answer for where governments are going to get the money to pay back their debts. The challenge with trying to tax the wealthy is the wealthy people move. The problem with trying to tax the population is they get restive and threaten revolution. And nobody is at a point right now where they are willing to tolerate any further reduction in their living standards or social services or wages. So governments are then going to have to tax something that doesn't move, which is property. So we can anticipate that there will be taxes on second properties, or there will be other forms of property taxation or corporation taxes on property or commercial property taxes. And then we can also think about carbon taxes, because anyone who is emitting carbon within a country can easily be taxed. And of course, it's also targeting corporations who are generally considered to be these target-rich, or it's a target-rich environment to tackle cash-rich companies for their carbon emissions. The fact that IBM came through today and said that they've developed a 2-nanometer chip was particularly interesting. The fact that the share was in negative territory after that kind of announcement, it does tell us a lot about the fact that the company still has a lot of work to do to make commercial successes out of the really incredible inventions that they can come through with on occasion. But I thought the interesting point was that the new chips can be upwards of 75% more energy efficient. And of course, that reduces the carbon footprint of data centers and other forms of heavily intensive computing. And then, of course, what's the thing that's most heavily intensive in terms of computing power? It's Bitcoin. Bitcoin's price was up about $1,800 in here today. Now, it's still in this rather inconsistent environment. When we look at the logarithmic scale, it was beautifully consistent on the way up off the lows in March. We had a series of ranges, one above another. We had every single breakout was sustained. That stopped in March, and since then it has done very little but go sideways to down. So we're now at a point where there's the clear potential that we could be in for more volatile trading. If we see that Bitcoin is targeted for carbon taxes, and it's one of the biggest emitters in the world by volume, so that's obviously something that is going to entice politicians. And then, of course, there is the threat of regulation. These are some of the challenges that are very little discussed. Then, of course, there is the opportunity, which everyone is aware of. So, in many respects, Bitcoin is the ultimate risk asset, because for the given level of risk, the output in terms of returns is really rather spectacular. But just like commodities, Bitcoin is best bought following significant reactions. And most particularly, it's attractive before the halvenings, and that's a 4-year cycle. What we are also seeing, and this is quite similar to what happened in 2017 and 18, is that Ethereum is now in a position of outperformance, and it peaked about 6 weeks after Bitcoin in 2018, and we're about 6 to 7 weeks on from the peak in March for Bitcoin on this occasion. So there are certainly some parallels that are worth considering. We also saw in here today a significant pop on the upside, which was not sustained for bonds. So that's a very long tail on the candle, and it is representative of the panicky environment where investors were thinking, well, golly, if we're not going to have a swift recovery in the pace of hiring in the USA, well, then perhaps it is worth buying these bonds. Buying the dip in bonds has been the most successful strategy for the entire sector for 40 years. So there is certainly a proclivity to want to buy the dip. And we still have a relatively overbought condition, excuse me, oversold condition relative to the trend mean. I've now imposed a stop on my position because I don't like the fact that it was not able to hold on to this gain. This today, at least at one point, could have been the massive reaction against the prevailing downtrend, which would characterize a type 2 bottom. The fact that it has not held, well, that really does help to highlight that investors do believe that we are going to continue to have very liquid environments and that there is going to be a clear determination by the USA to devalue the currency. And devaluing the currency and leaving the liquidity in the market for longer than it is strictly required is normal behavior. Now, gold has popped right back up to test the region of the simple moving average. And when we look at the exponential moving average, it's currently around the $1,800 area. Now, I do favor the exponential moving average more because I do think it is relevant to spend or to give greater emphasis to the most recent data. The big question now for gold is how well it can hold this break above $1,800. On each of the occasions that gold has pulled back since August, it has failed to hold breakouts. So now the next question is, having had the breakout, will it be sustained? If it does, well then we are now back on the front foot, and then we can start thinking about the clear potential that gold will cruise back through the 2000 level. And I think it is really not especially ambitious to think that gold will then break out in purchasing power parity terms. We've had an incredibly lengthy range in terms of purchasing power parity. And the $250 area has been an area of resistance since 1980. So if it can push up and through that level, well, then we really are back in a new secular bull market, and we are in a completely new price structure for gold. And then that would be a clear vindication of the view that investors are beginning to look beyond fiat currencies. The one thing that I think is in favor of gold is that it is part of the established financial infrastructure, and it's owned by central banks, and it's viewed as a hard asset and as a reserve asset. The challenge for cryptocurrencies is that central banks are desperate to improve the flow of liquidity. When we think about the blunt instruments that they currently use, they look at interest rates. So when they cut interest rates, they have to wait approximately 2 quarters before they can see the full implications of what they've done in financial data because of these lags. There's obviously then also been this long hiatus in the velocity of money. So that's an additional challenge. How do you get velocity of money to recover again? Because it could have rebounded in a very profound manner at the end of last year, and it didn't. So this is an additional question. You simply can't think about removing the quantity of liquidity until velocity of money starts to recover. So that does make central banks interested in central bank digital currencies. Because the number one thing that it does is it gives a ledger of all transactions. And if you completely do away with physical cash, then you also do away with a large portion of the shadow economy. And of course, it forces the shadow economy to come up with different ways of transacting, and barter becomes a much more significant factor. And then, of course, they will also move into unregulated digital currencies like the cryptocurrency markets. I certainly think about how cash has been largely excised from China. And it was about 3 years ago that we were in a taxi, and the change was made in a counterfeit currency. So that was a sign of some of the counterfeit currency being trying to circulate out of the economy because real cash was becoming so scarce. So that was like the tide going out, and all that was left in the market was the counterfeit currency. So we were coming into contact with it more often. But that's also representative of this clamping down on the shadow economy. And then you can think about how India tried to combat that with their demonetization. So there were stories at the time of trucks of notes driving around India looking for a destination to deposit them. And that obviously created an issue, and there was a big hiccup in the financial sector as a result. And then one of the other improvements was that unrest in Kashmir actually improved because a lot of, well, people don't fight if they're not getting paid. So we can think about how these kinds of issues are arising around the world, and the relative attraction that digital currencies have from the perspective of a central bank and from a government. Because governments are going to have to start taxing. They absolutely need to do something about the size of the deficits, and the deficits are extraordinary. So when we think about the fact that globally we're looking at a 2.3 trillion deficit and still climbing, then that is helping to support markets. It's helping to really to increase speculative activity. You have the Federal Reserve being the primary provider of global liquidity, and then also worrying about bubbly activity. And you don't get bubbles without central banks making mistakes. And considering the quantity of money that's been printed, and the very clear questions about the necessity of lockdowns, and whether that was in fact the best way to go about it, about tackling the pandemic, I was really amazed that nobody seemed to try quarantining. Because when I was a child, TB was a significant issue around where I lived in Ireland, and there was a TB hospital. So if you were diagnosed with tuberculosis, you were sent to the isolation hospital until it got better. And that was just the way of things. And I was amazed that that wasn't tried as a result of the pandemic. When we then think about what all this means for central banks and governments, well, they're going to have to come up with new taxes. So we're starting to see some populist rhetoric about workers' rights and rich people paying their fair share. We're looking at the potential that we're going to see a lot more carbon taxes. I fully anticipate that we're going to see efforts by companies to use this to their advantage. We're definitely starting to see in the agricultural sector and in the processed food sector that the food packagers are going to start layering on additional ways of inflating prices so that they can protect their margins. That's part of the reason why the dividend aristocrats continue to march higher, because they are able to protect their margins through shrinkflation or through other means, and it's virtually a surety that they're going to do the exact same thing that they did with the organic sector, with the fair trade sector, and now with carbon. So they're going to start reporting how much carbon it takes to make a carton of cereal, and use that as a rationale for why prices have to rise. We're definitely seeing that in the shipping sector. So we've seen that Maersk has come out and said that they're going to do exactly that. They're going to put a carbon premium on the cost of shipping, and that's how they're going to pay for compliance with the IMO 2020 regulations. That's of course the largest of the main shippers. Then we got smaller companies like Diana Shipping that are just on the cusp of breaking on the upside. When we think about digital currencies, that very clear ledger of transactions is going to make it a lot easier to track transactions. It's going to make them easier to tax. So instead of strictly raising the tax rate, they will just broaden the base that can be taxed. And making a ledger of every transaction in the economy is just golden news for any kind of government or central banker. Then, of course, they have the potential that when they do want to stimulate, they can put time limits on deposits, and they can even determine what people spend their money on. So that's obviously very attractive from the perspective of central planners. And in an environment where we have global deficits in the trillions, they're definitely going to come up with some way of attempting to tax people. So that's also likely to ensure that the very acute problems that could arise from the massive amounts of debt perhaps are prolonged, and we may not see an aggressive spike higher in government bond yields, at least in the short term. But the reality is that because the dollar is depreciating and the USA is far and away the most active in attempting to devalue its currency, then it's going to make bonds less attractive from the perspective of international investors. So I think it's quite likely that over the course of the next few years, we will see the 3% level revisited, but perhaps not right away. But certainly this move that we had in bonds, this in here today, it suggests that there is resistance to purchases around the 1.5% level. Now, when we think about stock markets overall, it would be quite easy to just simply look through large numbers of stock markets and highlight all those that are breaking on the upside. But it would be a very lengthy process because this pace of advance is picking up on Wall Street. There's absolutely no denying that. And it's not least because the dollar is so weak. If we redenominate the index, then the advance is less impressive in euro or in pounds. So, in many respects, the continued outperformance of Wall Street is very much tied to the continued devaluation of the currency. What we've seen in Europe is that the Euro Stoxx index is pushing on to new high ground, and this is particularly important as it comes all the way up to test the highs from back in 2000 and 2008. On this occasion, the push up to those highs looks a lot better supported than it was on either of the previous occasions, and it suggests that we're going to see these markets break on the upside. The FTSE 100 has been largely consolidating in the region of its all-time peaks over the course of the last 3 years, and it is pushing back above the 7,000 level again in here today. We also continue to see that small cap and mid cap stocks are continuing to break on the upside. And This is almost universally true. Small caps everywhere are continuing to outperform, and the second section index in Japan is now consolidating right in the region of the upper side of its range. The MDAX in Germany is also still in a clear position of outperformance. The small caps in the USA, represented by the Russell, have also firmed within their range. But it's also true that we can just think about the small caps right across Asia, and they have higher growth rates. Sorry, this one has been liquidated. I can't remember the exact ticker of the one that I had been looking at earlier on today. And this one, Aberdeen Asian Smaller Companies, is clearly consolidating above a very lengthy range. So small caps doing better is very much tied to the recovery in economic growth. The continued strength in commodity prices is also a play on global economic growth, and it is very clearly tied to this trend of commodities turning to sharp outperformance after recessions. We saw that right off the lows immediately after 9/11. We saw it again immediately after the panicky environment in 2008, and we've seen it again now in 2020. So as raw industrial commodity prices continue to march higher, then it's going to stoke inflationary pressures. But we can also think about that the Federal Reserve thinks that this is not going to last. So I think we have to just think about, why do they think that? Is it simply that it's convenient to say that inflation is not going to recover, or that inflation is not going to be permanent in nature and trend? Or what is it exactly that's informing that view? Well, I think perhaps the first thing that's informing their view is that we have these trends that evolve after these big pops on the upside, but then they tend to roll over. So commodity prices have rallied for a few years, and then they've rolled over during recessions. So they're probably thinking that commodities are largely a cyclical factor, and that they don't trend higher for very long periods of time. Of course, we had a very profound bull market in 2000 all the way through to 2011, and it created a lot of commodity price inflation. But it wasn't the kind of inflation that central banks get worried about. So they're probably thinking that this is deja vu, that we're seeing another big pop on the upside in commodities because we have very accommodative monetary conditions and we're seeing a recovering global economic environment, which is conducive to a lot of demand for commodities. They may be thinking then about what happens when the moratoriums on evictions end and the unemployment benefits expire. And that's probable in the next 3 to 6 months. So the unemployment benefits are going to expire at the end of August. And then the legal challenges to the moratoriums on the evictions are already starting to be successfully challenged. So we could start to see evictions beginning, and that is something that is going to obviously roil the economic recovery. And that would then, of course, have deflationary forces on the economy. And that's why they are not going to raise interest rates. So if we logically take all of that into account, it helps to explain why stock markets are still firm. So then if we think about the continued availability of liquidity and the fact that the IPO index is now below the trend mean, and that some of the most attractive the best performing assets in 2020 are now struggling, well, they're very think levered to liquidity. And the big question, of course, is if bond yields continue to march higher, then these are going to be impacted, because we've had a significant decoupling of the green sector from oil. Oil prices were the primary rationale for investing in renewable energy before the big advance, before the big decline. So oil prices crashed in 2008, and so did renewable energy. You couldn't really make a clear case for investing in renewables unless oil prices were really high. Well, that's no longer the case. You can have a big move in solar without a big move in oil because of carbon prices, and then also because of business model adaptations. So now they're much more interest rate sensitive, and that puts them in the same category as the IPOs and the other interest rate sensitive portions of the market. So if bond yields do start to push higher from here, and this tail that we see on the candle this week gets follow through, well, I'll be stopped out of my long position in bond futures for sure. But what it will also represent is really a headwind for the renewable energy sector, because they are acutely levered to the interest rates overall. So I think this is something to pay particular attention to as we look at what happens over the next week. What's also particularly relevant is that the uranium sector is now breaking on the upside. Cameco came through with earnings today, and they disappointed, but the share was up in a dynamic manner because they anticipate that demand for uranium is going to recover. And that is suggestive that we are coming towards the end of the global supply glut. And that's a pretty profound change for this industry. So this is definitely a big development. We're seeing that some of the most depressed sectors in the commodity complex are beginning to rally. Some of the most overextended sectors as a result of the swell of interest in stay-at-home sectors are just not gaining the same kind of attention. And the stay-at-home index, it was a little steadier in here today. It's right in the region of the trend mean, so it absolutely needs to bounce from the current area. When we think about the very large cap companies, they have pulled back in a rather dynamic manner over the course of the last week. We saw a little bit steadier action over the last 2 days for Amazon, but again, there's been a significant loss of momentum here. And of course, then we can think about the performance of the wider market on an equal weighted basis. In many respects, what we've had is a rotation, and it's a rotation out of a very small number of high-flying stocks and into a wider, broader recovery for the economy generally and the stock market generally. So the equal-weighted indices are definitely doing better. And the challenge for companies that are very interest rate sensitive is what happens if interest rates continue to push higher, and what happens as the dollar continues to decline and makes the USA less attractive from the perspective of global investors. We can think then that some of these liquidity hungry companies are going to continue to experience pressure, and that the commodity complex will continue to march higher, that we will also then start to see continued demand for the beneficiaries of the weaker dollar. So the Vietnam indices are pushing on to new high ground. The Indian market is in a geopolitical sweet spot right now. They certainly have issues, but it's looking increasingly likely that the latest wave of the coronavirus is close to peaking in India. And there is the much broader perspective that the rest of the world simply cannot afford for India to fail. So India is going to be provided with whatever assistance it requires in order to take up a convincing frontline opposition to China's global hegemonic ambitions. What I find particularly interesting is when we look at the performance of China's stock markets, the H-share index is going nowhere. It's been going sideways for a decade, and it would be difficult to come up with a convincing rationale for why it should be breaking on the upside along with everything else. The continued, I think, heavy-handedness that is being exerted by Beijing on Hong Kong is weighing on speculative interest. Then we can think about the performance of companies where their growth ambitions are being curtailed. Tencent is right back on the region of the trend mean. It's an incredible company, and it has pioneered the evolution of the global payments sector. But they're not going to be allowed to grow in nearly the same way as they had in the past. And then we can think about Meituan Dianping. They've gamified social media and the reviews sector, and it's would have been viewed as the potential significant new growth company, and yet it's also having its growth curtailed. So when we think about the CSI 300, it's consolidating in the region of the upper side of this range that's been forming now for a decade. And it would be tempting to think that it's in the same area as a lot of other markets that have reverted to the mean. But the challenge for China is that can it still claim to be a reliable partner for foreign direct investment? And can it be viewed as a reliable partner for trade? And this is a question that lots of companies are going to be asking. And they're going to be asking themselves whether the risk is worth it of investing in trying to tap into the domestic economy in China. So Tesla has had a taste of the difficulty that that arises. And in many respects, companies over the course of the last couple of decades have been honeypotted. So they're attracted into China, and they're allowed to get a taste of the returns from the market. And once they've got the taste, then the authorities come along and tell them what's what, and tell them what they need to do if they want to continue to benefit. And sometimes that's really very unpalatable, but there's not a lot they can do about it because they would have to go back to their shareholders and tell them that they're going to have to give up on a big slug of liquidity and profits. So in many respects, China uses the size of its market to cow companies into obsequiousness. And the stock market is now right in the region of the trend mean. So it really needs to bounce. And we don't have a lot of evidence for it, particularly since it was closed for most of this week because of the May holiday, and it didn't bounce immediately afterwards. I do think that there is clear potential that gold is going to continue to rally on the back of rising geopolitical tensions, on the clear determination to devalue the purchasing power of currencies, and for a clear demand for a hard asset overall. But gold doesn't go up in a straight line. It tends to bob around a lot, and the next big question is whether it is going to hold on to these recent gains. when we think about the broader global economy and the kinds of things that contribute to recessions, we're just nowhere near the next recession. The only real questions are how well can the very interest rate sensitive portions of the market deal with higher interest rates? And that's still a relatively small portion of the market. And we're seeing a significant rotation into the types of markets that do well in an inflationary outcome. And it is those kinds of companies that have got long histories of paying dividends, that dominate their respective niches, that have the ability to pass on higher prices, that they generally tend to do well in a broad economic recovery where there is the fear of inflation and where they're growing their business. So they get both growth and inflation protection. It's these types of autonomies and autocracies that generally tend to do best. So we can think about the kinds of autocracies that are out there, because it's still true that only about three, maybe four, companies in the world dominate the iron ore market. When we think about the size of the copper market, again, it's really only a small number of companies dominate copper. When we think about industrial gases, then again, it's only about three companies dominate the entire global industrial gases sector. When we think about the uranium market, it's the same thing. There's really only one or two very big players. When we think about the fertilizers sector, then we're still presented with a relatively small number of giant fertilizer companies. If we think about the processed foods sector, each of the processed foods companies have their own very clear niche in the market that they protect aggressively. And this is also true, that they tend to be favored by investors because of the reliability of their dividends. So if we just think about the magic number for dividends, it's about 3.5%. Every time we see the range or the yield getting up to around 3.5%, these types of companies bounce. So it's generally considered to be the rate at which investors will step in and buy companies. And it's not necessarily the same kinds of companies. There's also the private equity sector. So Roper Technologies is one of those. They deploy a private equity model, and that allows them to continue to pay dividends, continue to march higher, to dominate the little portions of different markets that they have developed technology for, and it allows the share to march higher. Thermo Fisher dominates scientific equipment, so continues to be in a really rather consistent trend, but it accelerated in 2020, so it's probably not going to be the one that is going to accelerate higher in 2021. We could be in for a lengthier period of consolidation. I think this helps to demonstrate is that there are plenty of types of companies that do well in an inflationary environment, but the ones that don't are those that don't have profits. And when you don't have profits, the hurdle for overcoming the objections of investors and to justify the multiple is really difficult when there's a high interest rate. And what it really means is that they're long duration assets. So if you don't have any earnings, it's a long duration asset, and they then become as sensitive to interest rates as long dated bonds. So we're definitely at a turning point in the market, because we can see where the clear performance is, we can see where the demand is, and we can see what happens in the at this portion of a recovery. And then, of course, there is the clear parallel for the unprofitable companies of 1999 and Y2K. Those companies, they looked like they were getting fantastic orders and that they would be able to achieve their valuations. And in the year 2000, interest rates rose and choked off the ability to access credit at exactly the same time that their earnings disappeared. So we can think about these kinds of companies that did phenomenally well during the pandemic, but they just don't, are unlikely to do well in a post-pandemic environment. We're definitely seeing that companies like Zoom and Peloton are coming back down again. Beyond Meat is one that did phenomenally well right off the IPO in 2019 and then pulling back aggressively again in here today. It's another company that is on an aggressive growth spurt but is not long on profits. And I think that this is something that is probably going to translate into a further transition as we move further into the year. The big picture is that investors are positioning themselves for inflation. Even though the Federal Reserve doesn't believe that the inflation is going to be permanent, they still think it'll be transitory. And we can just think about why they think that. But the sheer quantity of debt and the clear intention of governments to continue printing and to try and target their, so far at least, to target their tax measures at other portions of the economy, it probably means that they're going to use some of the proceeds to build. And that is why commodities are doing well. And these supply bottlenecks that we've seen arise over the course of the last few months are probably medium term in nature. In other words, they're going to take anything from 6 months to a year and a half to try and fully iron out. And that suggests that there's still upside here. And that's especially true if we don't see financial conditions tightening. I think with that, I will leave you for the weekend, and I'll wish all the best to all of you.